Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Caught Offside with Andrew Gundling and JJ Devaney.
Oh, yes, Caught Offside from Florida and from an apartment in Brooklyn, New York. Andrew Gundling and JJ Devaney. What's up, brother?
You seem slightly flustered there as to where you are.
Well, because I'm programmed to say certain words. There's a chip that's been inserted by you into my brain that forces me to say certain things at various points of the podcast. And when I have to deviate from that and use my actual human brain, it's hard. I'm here because my a quick little family trip. My parents are both hitting a milestone birthday. I'm hitting a milestone birthday. My sister and her youngest son, he's turning one. So they kind of wanted to do like a little getaway with all of us. I should say Florida. While I do enjoy Florida, it's, you know, where we're staying is really cool and it's nice and warm and it's great. It is very much the critter capital of the world. There's just critters everywhere. I don't know how else to describe them. Like there's caterpillars that are, they've just exploded, but they're everywhere. I've never seen anything like it. They've like consumed the area. And like, there's just other kinds of critters. And I'm not saying what's good or bad. It's just, there's just critters. There's critters.
Yeah. I want to explain the decor of the room you're staying in. I'm sure it's a lovely room, but it does have like, it's got wood paneling on the walls. Mm-hmm. I remember watching a documentary about how the IRA used to go to Florida to procure illegal arms at gun shows and do deals. And they were looking for a red eye surface to air missile launcher, the kind of thing that the Taliban used to defeat the Russian army in Afghanistan in the 80s. And it was, I think it was in that room.
Really?
So the FBI had a sting. The FBI said they were going to sell them. And the IRA showed up in the hotel room and literally told them exactly what they wanted, had the money and everything, and they were arrested. Yeah. And I think that was the room in which it happened.
Yeah,
and
I can't be even... There's a plaque on the door commemorating it. I wasn't sure what it was for, but thank you. But yeah, so here we are. My family, they've all gone to breakfast. I said, you all go, you'll be fine. And I'm going to go ahead and do this. And sometimes people wonder, wow, will he get in trouble for like just kind of sending his family off while he does this? JJ, after on my 10-year wedding anniversary trip in Rhode Island, when I woke up at like 7 a.m. in a hotel room to record after the Gold Cup win, I feel like I've kind of set a new expectation. This is happening. All right.
You've crossed the plane. It's over now. You record even when we stop this podcast way many years from now, when it's over and done with, as a ritual, you'll wake up and just record something because that's who you are now.
That's right. What a show this is going to be. This is going to be a lot of fun. God, so many things have happened in this sport over the last 72 hours or so. One of the most compelling matches in the history of the FA Cup. We'll talk about that. And then another one that was also good, not to the level of United Coventry, but we'll certainly discuss Chelsea and Manchester City as well. Huge things happening, of course, in the Premier League title race with both Arsenal and Liverpool winning over the weekend. Some U.S. men's national team developments that are not wonderful. Which we will discuss. So there's a lot to get to here. We'll get to it in a sec. I just want to remind everybody, still probably another week and a half or so for the Caught Offside Design a Shirt program. And I must
say, overwhelmed.
The animals, once again, they never cease to amaze me in their ability to rise to an occasion. And the thread going of ideas for potential Caught Offside merch, just things written on t-shirts. There's some genius ones in there. I'm getting a little worried as to how we're going to parse through what we decide to go with here. It's such good stuff. So by all means, keep them coming because I can't say that we're going to choose all of them. The idea here is we're going to choose one, But God, they've been a joy to read. I mean, it's really fun to see some of the ideas that you guys have and some of the things that I had kind of forgotten about on the show that clearly have stuck with some of you. And it's awesome. So there's still, I'd say, another week and a half or so, because we do want to get that summer merch line up on the Caught Offside page as soon as we can. So keep them coming and we'll make a decision within the next couple of weeks. And then hopefully one of those awesome ideas that you guys have, we'll get them up on a t-shirt. But thank you. I mean, it's what a cool thing the way you guys have come up with some thoughts on this. It's really, really been a lot of fun to see.
Yeah. Yeah. No, they always go to the well. Let's go to Wembley though.
Let's go to Wembley. I mean, we have to start with the match that Jonathan Liu at The Guardian, he referred to it as the greatest FA Cup moment that wasn't. And I think I mean, look, Manchester United fans obviously will be in a box here that have certain feelings on this. They're quite pleased, I would imagine, with the way this turned out. And I would expect them to do so, even if it wasn't by the way that they would have hoped it happened. The fact of the matter is they're into a final right now against Manchester City. And that's not a small deal. That's important. But I don't
think that's the feeling amongst them. There's like from talking to my friends that are United fans, there was like a sense of relief, but also because it was penalties in the end, the embarrassment is massive.
But you can't say they would have rather lost though.
They're
happy to be in the final, even if it wasn't in the way that they would have liked it to have gone.
I mean, when you're having a debate, obviously this was such a significant weekend. Obviously, having FA Cup semi-finals, that the Sky Sports team, who are at Craven Cottage for Liverpool-Fulham, or Fulham-Liverpool, rather, they discussed this. And Gary Neville, I think Luis Saha was there as well, Jamie Carragher, were like, do you even celebrate that if you're Man United? And they're like, no, you don't. It's quiet embarrassment, and you leave the ground.
I agree, which is why Antony's celebration at the conclusion of the penalties goes on the Mount Rushmore of oblivious moments in sports.
He's a fool. A man who's contributed one thing all season, who is the standard bearer for the failure so far of the Erik ten Hag era. He is the last man. Now, Harry Maguire did rescue the situation. It should be noted. He went to the Coventry players to commiserate with them immediately. And I think that was a balm over the, like, I do think there was that, that grand sense of, I got to be careful how I say this here, Englishness. I think that the Coventry players are very well aware of the kind of character Antony would be. And that he may not understand that this was totally gauche what he did and totally wrong, and just kind of looked at him like, what a dick, rather than anything else than that.
Yeah, it had that feel. Like, for anyone who didn't see, when Rasmus Højlund's penalty went in to seal it, Antony, he cupped his hand to his ear and kind of was looking over at the line of Coventry players taunting them. And it's just like...
And no sense of occasion, no sense of who you were playing, no sense of where they're from, no sense of how much smaller they are than you. This is a football club that, since its relegation from the Premier League and its move to the Ricoh Arena, I don't know what it's called now, where they moved out of Highfield Road in the early 2000s, went to a new stadium, which pretty much bankrupt the club. They haven't always been able to play their games in Coventry. This club was literally on the brink, has spent a decade and a half on the brink. This was a fantastic moment for them and their supporters. You're Manchester United. Do you even know who you're playing for? Like, that is, it's so classless. And it was 3-0, Andrew. They were cruising at 3-0. And then I think it was Craig Burley that said on the broadcast that this team can't take a punch in the jaw. Like, if things are going okay, they're fine. But the slightest setback and United are in trouble. I mean, this was absolutely that. It was 70 minutes at 3-0 against a eighth place team in the championship. what happened afterwards was absolutely crazy.
And I don't think you could have said that I saw it coming. Like, I don't know if there was a whole lot that happened in those first 70 minutes where you'd say, you know, this, we took the scenic route to get there, but we ended up at the right result as this one was heading into extra time. I don't know. I mean, United looked good. Like, and who was it? I forget who was on commentary for the broadcast, but when the third goal went in, the call was start making your plans now for the final. Like, you know,
can I tell you the truth? It's so strange to contrast how you treated the FA Cup as a child, FA Cup semi-final as a child compared to how you treat it now. I didn't turn it on until Coventry went to 3-2. So I'm watching Liverpool Fulham, and then I get the iPad out because this could be tasty. And the minute I put it on, it's just wave after wave of Coventry attack. Sky Blues pouring into the box. And you're like, who's the Premier League team here? Completely put on the back foot. Now, you must give credit to Coventry because they had some forays down the right-hand side. That's where the first goal came from, to get them back into it. But, you know, to keep going and to not accept your fate and to not say, well, look, we've knocked a Premier League opponent out in Wolves in the quarterfinal. Look at our fans here. I mean, maybe it's just me. I'm not a professional footballer, but it could be quite easy to put your hand on your hips and kind of just look around you and think, I got to drink this in because I won't be here again. But they didn't. They kept playing, and I guess they smelled blood in the water after the first goal.
Yeah, and I suppose that can happen. I mean, suddenly a seed of doubt goes in one side while a seed of belief is kind of instilled within the other, and then this is what you get. And look, I mean, now this one is a little bit different. I was going to say that this to a certain extent follows a little bit of a Man United script throughout the course of this season, of not playing well and finding a way to get a result. But again, for 70 minutes, I don't know that I felt that was the case. I felt they were fine. Like, it seemed like 3-0 was kind of an appropriate scoreline.
Yeah.
Now, it does follow the other script that we've seen, where United do have this propensity. While they can score late goals, they do give them up as well. I mean, we've seen it recently with Brentford. I can't remember the other recent one. But like, this has also been a thing with them throughout the course of the season, where they have exposed cracks that, you know, that teams pounce on late in games, but not to this extent. I mean, this was pretty shocking to see the way this played out.
It was. No, in fairness to Coventry, I thought Ellis Sims' goal was really, really good on 71 minutes. Good break down the right, and like a tidy finish past Onana. Callum O'Hare's goal, look, massive deflection, loops in over Onana. What's he going to do? He's rooted.
Yeah.
It is important, though, in a comeback like this. So you know, there's enough time to score three goals between the 70th and the 90th minute. Of course there is. But to rattle United, or to rattle any team that's leading 3-0, you have to get the goals fairly close together, the first two, to get you back into it. And that was crucial. So Sims, and then the bit of luck with O'Hare's goal. Sims was 71, O'Hare's goal was 79. That bit of luck is what you need. And then we've talked about consequential American moments in European football. This is right up there now. This is challenging right at the top, Andrew. Hadji Wright, I'd have to look back at my notes. I think I watched Hadji Wright play for the New York Cosmos when they were at Coney Island. I'd have to check. Maybe it was Hofstra. I'm not sure. But I never envisaged the journeyman career he's had. And he's still only, what, 25, something like that? And for him to pop up and take that penalty with such aplomb. I mean, we'll start with the penalty that equalizes, and then we'll move on. But in terms of both goals and performance, this is as consequential an American contribution as we've ever seen anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, what is it, a 95th minute penalty with your team trailing by a goal at Wembley in an FA Cup semifinal?
Against Manchester United.
It's an unbelievable moment for an American to suddenly find himself at the center of.
And how well did he take those penalties? First one and the one in the shootout.
Yeah, no, absolutely. In terms of where it ranks, I mean, we don't have to go too deep into it. In terms of, with regards to American goals, I don't know. I can't help it. Penalties are a little bit different to me than goals from open play. I can't help but feel that way. I just do. But the importance of the moment is without dispute.
The pressure.
Yeah.
90+5, ball on the spot against, I mean, the biggest team in the world, if you want, and to take it extra time and complete your comeback. Well, not. I mean, I guess completing the comeback. Yeah, completing the comeback. You don't have to go ahead. Amazing, absolutely amazing. And it was only a signifier of the drama to come.
Well, that was the thing that was so incredible about what transpired next. I think there was, you know, sometimes you see a team get near the top of the mountain, but they have a hard time getting over it. And then sort of, you know, it gets to extra time and United can steady themselves. But that wasn't really what you saw in this extra mm-hmm. time. If anything, I mean, we'll go through it, but like Coventry, they hit the underside of the crossbar.
Oh, my God.
And then they score a goal in as time is getting ready to expire. They score what appears to be the winning goal, but not for offside, for a extremely narrow toe offside of a player standing still.
Yeah, we should note that Bruno Fernandes did smash the underside of the crossbar and it bounced out. It was a great strike. And I mean, he, as poor of a captain as he's been and as poor of he's not even liked by a cohort of United fans in terms of his demeanor. But it's amazing. Remember the saga to get this guy over the line to get him to United. You don't want to consider the last few seasons of Manchester United without him in the side. It's a wasteland. But anyway, to the Coventry chances and specifically the offside goal, is this felt for a lot of people like our Skynet moment where the machines have gone too far, because by the letter, by, I mean, I don't know that. So from what we saw on screen, the way the lines were drawn, it's like what would you say? A half of a foot. Not, I don't mean measurement foot. I mean a foot, someone's foot. Mm-hmm. Hadji Wright's foot, half of it is offside. He's standing still. He's not actually got forward momentum. It's not like he's running through and has gained a huge advantage. I saw a really good thread that broke it down, even said, we probably don't have the screen frame rate to accurately judge whether that is offside or not. And we've taken this massive moment away from Coventry City. And let me tell you, in fairness to United fans, or at least the ones I spoke to, they were like, had that gone in, or when it did go in and I thought it was a goal, they were like, deserved, absolutely deserved.
Yeah, I mean, look, with regards to the Skynet of it all, I don't know. Like, he's offside. Whether or not it's close, does that matter? What makes it harder for me to stomach isn't necessarily how close it is. It's the action of what's occurring. Because you're right. If he's sprinting towards goal, that's one thing. But he's standing still. The stationary. I don't know. He's offside.
I mean, look,
it is offside.
I called it. I knew it was going to be offside the minute I saw it. Like, you could, from the pictures we're shown, from the frames we're shown, from all the information we have. I really probably shouldn't have brought up picture frame and stuff like that, because I didn't have that information, nor did the VAR. So just from what we have, he's offside. He's offside.
Yeah.
And it absolutely stinks. But from a spirit of the law, spirit of the moment, sense in which it was a good passage of a play and a deserved goal, it seems like an absolute travesty.
Spirit of the law is the one I probably, spirit of the moment, you can't allow that to get into your way of thinking as to what, like, just because you want to see a certain result, like that can't have any sort of bearing on.
Look at you, Andrew, dragging me back to the reality of life.
It just can't. I mean, look, it was a fairy tale moment that wasn't, kind of like what Jonathan Liu said. What I'm trying to figure out here next, and then in penalties, you know, it a couple missed by the one skied over the bars. That's tough. That's kind of, it feels like it's the pressure of a moment kind of getting to a player. And that's a tough thing to see. And then Manchester United take advantage and win it.
I mean, we should talk about Casemiro. Like, what a dreadful penalty to begin proceedings from Casemiro. Again, another man, the standard bearer of everything wrong with United. Just a pathetic penalty. I had a moment, and I really, it's one of those where you're like, no, not for me. Callum O'Hare, the way he came up, the confidence with which he came up to the penalty spot, just was completely off-putting to me. I'm like, he's definitely, this is getting saved. And Onana did save it. Wasn't a great penalty.
Yeah.
He had the look of a man far too confident, far too at ease with the situation. And I had no faith. And then, obviously, I mean, what can you say about a player like Sheaf? Like, the captain of the club, had played brilliantly during the game. For him to miss that penalty and sky it like that was just, I felt terrible for him.
Yeah, it's a tough result for Coventry. A heroic one. I mean, this will be a run that their fans look back on quite fondly. I mean, the memories of this, certainly how they got there with their dramatic win at Wolves, and then just, you know, to come back from 3-0 down in the final 20 minutes of an FA Cup semifinal is a memory that you, I think you have to hold that in a certain high regard, regardless of how the rest of it went down. It's a tough one. It'll be bittersweet, but it's an amazing run by Coventry City. On the United side, the thing that I'm wondering about, so I saw this afterwards, Roy Keane was on ITV. He said, I can't believe what I'm watching. You're looking for leadership, but it isn't there. And with stuff like that, I think, first of all, I would have to ask, is that true? Like, is there a lack of leaders on that team? And if so, Erik ten Hag is going to pay for this. I mean, I think, you know, we'll see what happens. It could still go on and beat Manchester City in the FA Cup, and we can have a whole separate debate as to whether or not that should be enough to save a manager's job. I'm getting closer and closer to the point where I say I don't think it is. You don't want to let a trophy like that necessarily paper over real cracks that are there within the club. But there's a debate to be had. But with regards to this, a lack of leaders on the team, if that's one of the biggest problems that you see, is that a manager shortcoming, or sometimes, like I talk about all the time, do you sometimes have to look at the players themselves and ask some questions?
It's probably a bit of both.
Is Harry Maguire not a leader?
Sometimes
he is. Sometimes when he's not,
it's tough for him though, because I don't think he's a natural leader, Andrew. And he's also had such a tough few years personally. I mean, there was a while where he wasn't even guaranteed to be a starter.
That's the problem. That's the problem, is I think that you say he's not a leader naturally. I think he might be. But the problem is, I sometimes wonder, is it hard to lead when your play isn't up to the standard that you're kind of maybe demanding of others?
I think as well, the leader that you would think should be emerging at 26 years of age is Marcus Rashford. Wow. Local lad, we know his history with the club, partly through injury, partly through this just weird palsy of form that he's going through. He is not taking the reins of this team. He can put out as many statements as he wants on the coach's voice or whatever it is, what's that, Players Tribune. Doesn't matter. Like, he's not, you know, you just look at his demeanor, everything. He's not a leader. He's not leading this side. And there's no, I mean, Scott McTominay, I suppose, led through example for a portion of the season. But again, the real thing for me was the manager, when you see, and again, he's an exemplar, but I'm sure it happened with Pochettino, and I know it happened with Mourinho and John Terry and Frank Lampard. Managers kind of bestow that confidence and create leaders. Like when Klopp came into the club, if you'd have told me, well, two of the leaders of this club going forward are going to be Jordan Henderson and James Milner, I would have said no. I mean, one of those will definitely be gone. But it's not like Henderson, that mantle was bestowed on him. And if you talk to him about it or hear about that early Klopp era, Klopp gave the confidence. Klopp found the leaders, made the leaders, created the leaders. You can say with Van Dijk, he bought a natural leader from the back. That's true too. I look at Ten Hag. I saw Ten Hag on the sideline during extra time and before penalties. Andrew, I don't think he has the charisma for this job. And look, you can say, well, Mourinho had plenty of charisma. LVG had plenty of charisma. Oh. Where what happened there? But there were periods, at least, where you could say, well, there's a defined capo. There's a defined man at the top of this group who's leading this. Ten Hag is at sea. He just seems utterly at sea and floundering. And it doesn't help that English isn't his first language. It doesn't help that he is a dour man. Those things don't help either. There's no quick, witty comment that can kind of deflect from what's going on around him that Mourinho had. And he can't take hold of a press conference, and he doesn't look like he can take hold of the team on the field. That, and I feel for him as well, because he's clearly a coach of some merit. But Keane's right. There are no leaders. And Keane is a proper football man in that sense that he always talks about, well, when I went into the dressing room at United, there was all-time players, Steve Bruce, Paul Ince. Okay, fine. They're not there anymore. So the manager has to find someone and, like I said, bestow that rank on them, and he hasn't been able to do that. And just as characters, just as people, just look at them from what we know. There's just no captains there. There isn't.
Well, I mean, Casemiro could have been somebody who maybe was brought in with this in mind.
The problem with Casemiro is this. If you are giving someone the captaincy, then the captain does lead by example, right? Casemiro can't play anymore. So it's very hard for him to take an authoritative role. Same as Harry Maguire, who doesn't always start. Mm-hmm. That's the problem. Like, Keane was a leader who led by example. Keane could shout at Gary Neville and Phil Neville and destroy, Mikel Silvestre if he wanted. Because why? Well, because he was putting in the standard, and you had to get to that standard. There's nobody in United doing that.
Yeah. What a game. Just an unbelievable, all-time memorable game, even if it wasn't the result that a lot of the neutrals craved. But props to United. They are into the final.
On Coventry as well as a place, Andrew, bombed extensively during World War II. A lot of its cathedral was destroyed. There's just a shell of it remaining. But it got hit really badly in the Blitz. And a lot of people, the first thing they think of when they hear of Coventry is not obviously sports or Coventry City Football Club. It's a bombing during the Blitz.
Yeah, well.
Just because I thought I'd tickle your World War II bone a little bit.
That's interesting. That is interesting. Let's go now to the other semifinal, which Manchester City prevail 1-0 over Chelsea.
You'll have to help me with this one, Andrew. And again, this is part of a broader conversation about what FA Cup semi-final weekend has become. I didn't watch it.
Okay.
I didn't watch it. I just assumed City would win it. City versus Chelsea just at Wembley just had no appeal for me, so I didn't watch it.
Fair enough. There's two things that stand out to me from this one that I would mention. The first one being, I mean, we can go to the winning goal that was scored by Bernardo Silva. And I mean, look, if you can look at these two semifinals and kind of compare them in certain ways, if Coventry falling to United shows the cruel side of the sport, there is something, and bear with me, because I know you won't find anything reassuring necessarily about Manchester City going into a final, but there is something reassuring about Bernardo Silva getting a late winner for City, because we like him and we think he's a tremendous player. And I think just look at what has happened to this guy in the span of like a few days. Like, this sport has such a unique ability to fluctuate players from GOAT status to hero status in the blink of an eye. Midweek, Bernardo Silva has to suffer through the embarrassment of an all-time terrible penalty in a huge moment, a penalty down the middle that is basically caught by a goalkeeper. And then later that very same week, he scores a goal that takes his club into the FA Cup final. I think that there's something cool about that. And I like Bernardo Silva. So I don't mind seeing a guy like that kind of end the week on a high note the way that he did. He's a great player. And, his career won't be and shouldn't be defined by a terrible penalty that he took in a big moment against Real Madrid. So that's one side of it. The Chelsea side, God, they're so interesting. They have turned into they won't be at the top of anybody's power rankings, but my just like, I'm intrigued by them power rankings. They're very close to the top. They've had such a weird season. This game encapsulated so much of it. I'm going to read this to you. This is from Jacob Steinberg in The Guardian. And he wrote this about the day that Chelsea had. He said, credit goes to Maurizio Pochettino for a positional flex that flummoxed City for long spells. Pep Guardiola, all flapping gestures and nervous energy on the touchline, would soon be engaged in frantic conversation with John Stones about some minor tactical detail. This, it must be pointed out, was not for show. City were loose. Chelsea had joy on the break. Their plan was working. Nicholas Jackson, raw and frustrating, while still managing to carry a constant threat, was a handful. If only he had confidence in his left foot. And that's the thing, is like, once again, the story of the Chelsea season, they do have chances. They have opportunities to score goals, and Jackson, among others, were wasteful. And I don't know how some how great some of these players were. Some Chelsea players kind of just let them down in big moments. Jackson, Caicedo had one. Chilwell, late in the game, if he finds Raheem Sterling, they probably score. That's the confusing part of the Chelsea season. The manager, you know, he's taken a lot of the slings and arrows for this season. But like I always say, a manager can only do so much. He can set the team up to succeed. And I think in a lot of respects, Pochettino has done that. Not all the time, but overall, I think you can look at it and say, Chelsea, they have opportunities. The players have to execute it. And it's a young team. They're still learning how to execute on the highest level with consistency. But like Chelsea consistently underperforming their XG is a sign for me that the manager is not necessarily the reason that Chelsea are scuffling or that they don't win as much as they should. It's a sign that he has the right ideas, and there could still at some point be an uptick to the mean. Now, it's a little too late for that probably this season, but just kind of like projecting down the road, I think, you know, if there are Chelsea fans that think he should be gone after this, I think that's they're wrong. I think that would be the wrong move here.
Problem is, we're talking about, you know, the manager may have the right system, the manager may be doing the right things, the players aren't executing. Chelsea, it appears, will not be in a position to just go and get rid.
Which may not be a terrible thing. Now, look, I am not saying that it's a good thing for a team to have financial constraints over what they can do on the transfer market. That's not good, especially a team like Chelsea that could potentially buy big name players. It's a marquee club in London. But like, there is also something to these guys struggling through a year under a new manager, trying to figure out the system, and maybe cohesiveness and stability is not the wrong way to go. Again, they're the youngest team in the Premier League. So like it's not crazy that they would have a season like this where they kind of struggled in this way. Maybe it's not awful that Todd Boehly, who has shown in the past, I mean, it's his MO. I'm just going to buy, give me a name. Okay, I'll buy him and we'll figure it out later. Well, maybe the fact that power is going to be taken away from him might not be the worst thing in the world. If that does wind up happening, I don't know what the PSR situation is going to be with them, only what we hear. But like, it may not be awful that he doesn't have the chance to suddenly just start swapping in other random players for players that are there now. You know, that maybe a cohesive future for them isn't necessarily a terrible thing.
No, I think there was a period where, well, we're all offering Pochettino time, and that patience didn't last that long because the results were just not getting better. Yeah. But you're right. Sometimes you have to work the process, stick to the plan, and the underlying metrics for Chelsea are much, much better. And so I think you're right. It, to deviate now and kind of say, okay, that didn't work, remove the manager, try it again, I think that would be a mistake.
Yeah. Now, the problem is what they'll have to do. Like, if Conor Gallagher is the one that has to go because he's a Chelsea youth player, like, they can get the most money for him and they have no choice. Like, that's wrong. That's not good. That's a piece that they can't afford to lose. Whereas, you know, Nicholas Jackson, who, look, if you simply swap in a top line striker for him, Chelsea are probably better. So like, that's where they'll get hurt with their PSR situation. But, you know, large scale personnel changes, that I think is maybe not necessarily the way to go. But I'd be curious to hear what Chelsea fans think on that one. But it is Manchester City that go through. I don't have a ton else on this one. I mean, it was, you know, for a 1-0 game, there were definitely chances. It was not a dull Wembley late in a cup kind of game. Like, it was, there were opportunities for both of these teams. There was some entertainment value to this one, but as is the case so often, it's Manchester City that find their way into the final, and we'll have a rematch of last year's FA Cup final with Manchester City and Manchester United. But we have time to kind of preview that. I don't know that we need to get too in-depth on that one right now. Should we go back, JJ, from the FA Cup to the Premier League?
Yes, I think so.
Okay. The title race, Arsenal and Liverpool, both in desperate need of a win over the weekend, and they both do get them. You want to start with Arsenal?
Yeah. I mean, the papers were saying they grounded out at Wolverhampton, at Molineux. Yeah, they definitely did. It was Trossard came up with the goal. Weird kind of goal. Like, a really good finish. Gabriel Jesus has fallen over, does very well, as he often does, to keep the ball alive. And Trossard slashes at it, completely slices it, hits off the side of the post and into the net. But, you know, prior to that, I think it was Raya made a massive save, not a few minutes before that, where, like, Wolves were looking dangerous, tip one onto the post. And, like, for the rest of the game, I wouldn't say Wolves, like, really made life difficult for Arsenal. They didn't. Arsenal still had a lot of the ball, and did that thing where, yeah, they have a lot of the ball. They're in the box, in and around the box. Are they creating chances? Not a ton, but Wolves weren't really doing anything at the other end. And eventually Martin Odegaard pops up with a really, really clever finish on the sideline to nip it between Sa on the post, and 2-0. And Arsenal deserved the victory. It was so important to get that. Wolves potentially could have been much more trickier opponents than they were. But like, at this point of the season, Arsenal have one clear objective. After losing to Aston Villa last weekend, they had to win this. They did win it. Not, I wouldn't say there's a ton else to say about that game, but if you're chasing a title, that's a solid away victory. That's it, really.
Yeah. And then the other one, Fulham and Liverpool. Similarly, Liverpool 3-1 over Fulham. They get the win that they so desperately needed. A lot of the interest in this one, I mean, we can talk about the game, but some of it from before the game, when you looked at the team sheet that Jurgen Klopp put out there specifically, yeah. I mean, a lot of changes. McAllister not in the starting 11, but Mo Salah, I think, is one that a lot of people are keying in on and what that means.
Yeah, they are. I mean, I do believe what... I mean, Salah looked very, very tired. We should talk about Atalanta and the limp, damp squib that Atalanta was last Thursday night. And I think that informed a lot of the decisions that were made. It was as inept a performance as Liverpool have put together, considering they, you know, I'm sure a lot of Liverpool fans were like, the minute that they got the penalty for the handball and then they scored, oh, the remontada is on. Nothing of the sort. Now, Klopp put it down to like a tactical, you know, sometimes we get the tactics wrong. I think he said the tactics were S. Sometimes that's all it is. They were like trying to get the ball back to front very quickly, ended up driving balls into the channels. I can't tell you how many long balls there were. And there was nobody close to the guy running onto the ball. If he even got close to the ball, often it just went through to their keeper, their center backs. So it was a complete mess. Salah looked very, very tired, missed what you would call it was a great chance. And basically Klopp, after the Fulham game, explained the changes by saying, look, we play Thursday, Sunday, Wednesday. You know, as much as I'd like to say we can keep playing all the same players, you can't. And so they swapped it up, and we ended up with a midfield three of Gravenberg, Endo, and Elliot. And you just felt like, oh, this is going to be a lot of work for Endo and Gravenberg, particularly, well, for Endo, really, considering that Elliot will definitely be further forward up the field, Gravenberg too. So curious how to see that worked out, how that would work out. I think Liverpool were fairly dominant the first period of the game. A brilliant free kick by Trent Alexander-Arnold into the top corner, settled things. But actually, Fulham were very, very good then for the, we say, the 20 minutes before halftime, and they equalised with Castagne's goal, which was, again, a nice goal by Fulham, a good move. And you start to worry then, but a key moment in the second half for the Gravenberg goal was on 53 minutes was an interception by Harvey Elliott. Alex Iwobi trying to play a ball across his own in front of his own penalty box, and Elliott reads it, intercepts it, and a signing that for me hasn't impressed me or done anything. Gravenberg pops up, gets it out of his feet, and curls a beautiful one in off the post. That settled things, and then Jota added one later on. So the changes worked. Was it a perfect performance? No, it was a much, much better performance and had more zip and energy than the previous two, we'll say.
Yeah.
Previous two or three, actually, the two Atalanta games and the Southampton game. So no complaints. Again, the brief was the same as the brief Arsenal had. Just win the game. Don't you can't afford any more. Win the game. City not playing. We're in the straw-clutching zone right now, Andrew. There's not much straw to be clutched. In fact, I would say in my apartment, we are in a crisis mode of trying to get all the straw together that can possibly be clutched. But if there is bits of straw to be clutched, it's that City didn't play this weekend and they play their game on Thursday against Brighton. And maybe psychologically, the fact that they didn't play and then Arsenal go top and Liverpool join top, maybe that makes some kind of difference. I don't know. But that's what happened. Not much else really to say about that.
Yeah. I mean, the Salah thing is the thing that's most interesting to me.
I didn't really address that. I just based on performance in the last few weeks, he was not guaranteed to start for me. But he's such a key player. We've said regularly on this podcast, volume of goals alone, he's been Liverpool's most important player for the last 5-6 years. That said, I think Jota in this stretch run now is so important. He's got those few games under his belt coming back from injury. The injury he sustained against, was it Brentford? He's a killer, Andrew. He's a killer in the way that Diaz might not be, that Gakpo certainly isn't. It's good for him to get more minutes and more playing time. He's going to be, if there is to be an upset here and Liverpool are to wrench the title back from City, Jota's going to be key.
Yeah. I mean, I saw Salah not playing, and for me, it was simple. Like, you've got this game, Everton are midweek, and you've got West Ham at the weekend. What is it, like 4 games in 10 days, I think, is what this comes out to be. Like, look, you might have to pick your spots with certain players the same way Rodri had to rest against Luton for Manchester City. Like, it's not crazy to think that. But others are seeing it differently. Like, Jamie Carragher, he said afterwards about Salah, he doesn't think it's a fatigue issue. He said, when you look at some of the players who have been left out, you might look at Mo Salah. Salah is not an issue with tiredness because he stayed here during the international break. He's been injured in the middle of the season, and he's not playing well enough at the moment. It might be the case he'll be better and sharper from the bench. He said, I understand McAllister. He's played an awful lot of football, and it was always going to be difficult to play 4 games in 10 days away from home. Jamie Carragher thinks that this is the transition of Mo Salah into super sub. I'm not there. I disagree with that. I'm not. He knows more than I do. But if Salah's not starting against Everton, I'd be stunned.
I think it's the period right now, and it's his form. He's not in good form. Put it all together, and that's what like, it's a lot of games. I just think it's this specific moment we're in right now, and obviously there's the conversation about his contract. He's got 1 year left. He'd probably go in the summer if we know what Liverpool are doing. So, I think this was Klopp managing what he had. I didn't love it, by the way. When I saw the team, I was like, McAllister not in sight, etc. But there was a freshness for most of the game, at least.
Yeah. Let's see. Premier League, just a couple other things. I know you wanted to mention Crystal Palace and West Ham. I know you had some thoughts on that.
I had. So I must say, it was, we've got a lot of West Ham listeners. I don't want to bounce on the coffin here, but the opening 30 minutes for Crystal Palace in the final third was the Premier League footballing version of an and one mixtape. And it went right through to the second half too, with the Mateta goal and a nutmeg assist by Eze. Like, you don't recover from that. Kurt Zouma, I think, will have to retire now. If I'm him, I'm retiring. There's no coming back. Eze and Olise and even like Will Hughes, and like they ran riot. It was stunning. It was amazing to watch, and I loved Eze's flamboyant finish for the second goal, the scissors kick into the empty net. Like, just brilliant, absolutely brilliant. Crystal Palace are outrageously entertaining. when they want to be, which is not something I would have said that a team that was mostly managed by Roy Hodgson this season. But yeah, it's so much fun. The overriding feeling, though, from the game for me is that this is the end of the David Moyes era. Like West Ham have had a great few years, but you know, one shot on target. I mean, I know they scored two goals, but one shot on target. When you compare the, you know, just the freedom and the entertaining football that Crystal Palace put forward. And then you look at West Ham, you think, oh, that was poor. But they've got Paqueta, Ward-Prowse, Kudus starting as part of the attack. They're too good to be taking a five-goal shellacking at Selhurst Park. And that's where it falls back on the manager. What's going on here? And I think we've reached the end of David Moyes at West Ham.
Maybe. We've been speculating on that for a while. The Crystal Palace thing, I will forever, like I said last week, I wish we could have seen a full season of this team where Elise and Eze could have really like built up a full season of chemistry and momentum. I just would have been so curious. They might not have won any trophies. They might not have been in contention for Europe or anything like that, but I think they might have been one of the most box office teams in the league this season if we had a full season of it.
Yeah, we got to give Oliver Glasner credit for the medical staff for making sure everyone got on the field. But you're right, it was so fun. And now the summer becomes the summer of where are Eze and Olise going to end up.
Uh-huh.
That's what's going to happen. And personally, just for the vibes, I hope they stay a little bit longer at Crystal Palace.
And then finally, JJ, the last thing we wanted to finish with was what happened between Everton and Nottingham Forest, where Everton win 2-0, important win for them. But a lot of the story here revolves around Nottingham Forest and specifically a tweet that was sent out after the game. So there were a few, and we'll get to the calls, but there were a few, let's just say, questionable calls in this game, none of which went Nottingham Forest's way. And so after the match, this tweet was sent out by the official Twitter X account for Nottingham Forest. It says, three extremely poor decisions, three penalties not given, which we simply cannot accept. We warned the PGMOL that the VAR is a Luton fan before the game, but they didn't change him. Our patience has been tested multiple times. NFFC will now consider its options. That is a historic statement, I think. Mm-hmm. I don't remember really. I mean, this is fan stuff that is coming from an official team social media account. It's quite remarkable. Has a
club, as an entire entity, ever been charged with bringing the game into disrepute? I don't think that an entire club. I thought they probably have, actually. I think United and Arsenal had a fight in 1990 on the field, and I think that was. This is Andrew. This fun, like, do they realize what they're doing? They're fundamentally undermining the whole system and premise on which football is played, that the referees and the officials are impartial. And by the way, you look at every one of the incidents they're talking about. Not that we shouldn't actually be doing this. But if you look at the incidents, I could say that I didn't think the Reina one was a penalty. I think it's possibly simulation. The other two, maybe one of them was a penalty. But this undermines.
I thought all three were.
Okay,
I thought all three were penalties. If I'm Nottingham, look, I'm not saying what Nottingham Forest did was bat-ass crazy. It's not right what they did. If they wanted to voice those kind of complaints, you do so behind closed doors and in some other way. But to put that out publicly, you're right. It undermines the integrity of the Premier League. And the Premier League, there's been an increase in this year, whether we go back to Arteta's comments after the Newcastle game all the way up through today. This stuff is on the rise. And the Premier League, they can't do it now. I mean, maybe they will. Maybe there's a heavy fine headed Nottingham Forest way. I don't know. But they have to wrap their arms around some of the comments that these teams are making after games about the officiating. That's just something that has to be handled. But I won't sit here and say I don't understand why Nottingham Forest were so frustrated.
Yeah, Andrew, I like bad calls happen, though. Like, you can't, your response to it then can't be to undermine, like, the entire system on which football is based, which and officialdom is based. You can't do it. I have a serious problem with what Forrest. I know what you're saying about the, you know, Liverpool wrote a had a very strongly worded statement after the Tottenham game, and I thought, you know, we're considering our options. I thought that was wrong. I thought Arsenal's letter was wrong as well. I would go as far as to say that this is a step beyond that. But Nottingham Forest have been winding up for this. Mm-hmm. They've appointed Mark Clattenburg as their referee's advisor. Surely, like, people were asking, what was the process that led to the social media account being, the social media officer tweeting this out? And I'm pretty sure it was the owner, Marianakis. I mean, this is a guy who's been handed a 5-month pitch ban for abusing a ref in the Greek league for Olympiakos. He was, you know, he's a guy that, how shall we put it, likes to get involved. I'm reading here, Marianakis was one of 28 people in late January to be acquitted of corruption charges relating to allegations of match fixing between 2012 and 2013. This is a, in Greek football, his explosions at the officials is very well noted. I don't believe for a second that this is, like, Mark Clattenburg is basically being installed so they can say, well, this came from our referee's assessor. This came from our official, our rules guy, whatever. This is coming straight from the top. Does anyone believe not? And Nottingham Forest don't have a leg to stand on with the way they've acted. I think this is obfuscation. I think this is a smokescreen. Forest are, don't forget, they're awaiting the result of an appeal. I think it's, what's the term that Steve Bannon used when Trump was running for office, how to confuse, how to cause problems, flood the zone with shit. That's what this is here. Let's get as much stuff in and create problems and the FA will be like, oh, well, you know, we've got so much coming from Nottingham Forest now. We can't do this. We can't do that. You know, we will try and maybe not come down so hard on them then to try and look as fair and as impartial, because maybe you're right, Andrew, there was refereeing mistakes here. Maybe in some way this can mitigate against any further PSR points deductions that are coming, which we know are pretty arbitrary in the way that they're given out. Mm-hmm. That's what I think is happening here. This is a pure tactic by the owners of Nottingham Forest to do as Steve Bannon said, create as much confusion, create problems, put the Premier League under pressure, flood the zone with S.
Yeah, and it'll be fascinating to see how the Premier League responds to this, because they can't be quiet on this one. This is a huge accusation that Nottingham Forest have leveled against the integrity of the league.
It also gets their fans on side. Like, it creates, have you seen Nottingham Forest X? They're all in lockstep behind the owner. An owner who has ran this club irresponsibly, right? Totally ran it irresponsibly in terms of, like, signing 180 players or whatever it was, and not being able to function the bookkeeping within the guidelines of PSR. So, you know, this is a tactic for me, a total tactic. And it's surely something that's come from the top. Do we honestly think it's come from anyone else?
No. No, this is something that inflammatory couldn't come from anywhere else. I mean, the owner would have
someone's
to
sign off on that.
Yes. Yeah. Anything else from the weekend, JJ?
No, but I definitely didn't think in the first half of the podcast I get an IRA guns deal in and Steve Bannon right before the break. So
how about that? One thing I did want to mention, actually, with the top four race, just that Destiny Udogie is going to miss the rest of the season for Tottenham, which is a brutal blow, I would say, for them. I mean, a player who's been so incredibly important to them this season in a system where the fullbacks are so vital. That's tough. Tottenham are going to have to, you know, Pedro Porro also dealing with injuries. So it's fullbacks on both sides that have been so vital to them.
And Udogie's been great. He's really been great. The fans really like him.
Yes, very much so. They're going to have to figure it out. It's not, do they have depth there? Emerson Royale. Look, you know, I love Ben Davies, but they're putting these guys in a big spot here. Tottenham, you know, Ange is going to have to make some lineup shifts here to make this all work. I don't know. It's not good. It's certainly not good. I'll tell you what, let's go ahead. We'll take a break. Come back on the other side. El Clasico. Got to talk about that. What a game with some controversy there. I know you had something on MLS you want to mention and a couple U.S. men's national team notes that are of real importance as well. More Caught Offside still to come. Oh, back now on Caught Offside. So, JJ, like I mentioned, I'm here. I'm in Florida on this little quick kind of family trip. And one thing I wanted to ask about, you know, sometimes we talk a little bit about airline travel and, you know, the headaches and things that can come along with it.
Yeah.
So our flight was supposed to leave at 5:50 in the morning on Saturday. And, you know, you can't get to the airport right away. Obviously, you have to like wake up ahead of time. But so at some point during the night, at like 1:30 in the morning, I got a text. I was asleep, obviously. It's the middle of the night. I got a text message saying that our flight had been canceled.
Oh, no.
I shouldn't say canceled. The time rescheduled to 9:30 in the morning. But we had a connecting flight in Detroit that left at 8:45. So we were obviously screwed. Like, we were going to miss that flight. This message gets sent at 1:30 in the morning for a 5:50 a.m. flight. And I wake up. I don't look at my phone right away because I set an alarm for 3:15. I'm like, okay, quick shower. And then let's get, you know, we have a car, an Uber that was, I set a time to come pick us up at 3:45 to get to the airport. And like, bang, bang, we're moving. I got two kids who are 4 and 8. Like, there's not a whole lot of time going on here. And so after I get out of the shower, I just look at my phone to see if there was any updates from the Uber. And I see this text message that had been sent at 1:30 in the morning while we were all asleep. Now, is that okay? Like, that's, to me, that's not okay. And then you're left to your own devices. There's no like, no, that they automatically rebooked us on another flight, but it causes us to miss our connection. So we're screwed. Now, my wife scrambled and found, while, you know, I was canceling the car service and all that, like, she found a flight that left from JFK. So now we're switching to a different airport. Like, this is not okay to me that flights can be a flight that leaves at 5:50 in the morning can be canceled essentially at 1:30. And you're just kind of left to figure it out. People, like, look, we're not rolling in money here. People,
no.
People save up a lot of their money to take a family trip. And like, they plan this stuff around their, you know, air travel and all that. And like, I feel like there's very little regard from airlines. Like, they'll just cancel flights on a whim and kind of leave you to figure it out. Like, I'm not saying I have the answers to what they should be doing instead, but, you know, how can that happen? Like, it's just, there was no bad weather. Like,
I have so much sympathy for you, but I've also so much like, this is the power airlines have. They if there's something happened and they cannot do what they're going to do, they'll just cancel, or they'll tell you it's taken off earlier or it's taken off later. And there's nothing really you can do. You can scramble like your wife did, but essentially your plans are changing. That's always been the case. I should say they
rebooked. They rebooked one flight and got us to Detroit for a connection flight that then left at like 5 o'clock that night. So we'd be sitting in Detroit for like 7 hours, and our whole first day of our trip would have been lost, which we've already paid for. Like, that's, again, like, people save up a lot of money to be able to do this stuff.
I totally agree with you, but airlines are like, there's nothing we can do. Take this one, for example, and I'll make it quick. We went home at Christmas with the baby. So we brought Roisin, who was like, what was she, like 8 months, whatever. And we had a bassinet seat, which is a seat that attaches to bulkhead and you can put the baby in. It's like a little cradle for the baby to sleep in. It's essential. Otherwise, the child will be trying to sleep on you all flight. We had it on the way over. It was booked for the way back. We turn up at the airport. We're told we don't have the bassinet seat. We're going to have to carry her for the entire flight. And she doesn't, at this point, she doesn't like to sleep on us. She likes to sleep in a bed or flat. And I'm like, what? We booked it. And like, we can show you where we booked it. Oh, it doesn't matter. Airline policy. They didn't have enough, whatever way the flight was. And like, there was other young parents on the flight as well that had the bassinet seat. Nothing you can do. Do you want to go home? Would you like to go home in the air, in the sky? Suck it up then. It's the way it is. It's so frustrating, but that's the way airlines are.
Yeah. So at any rate, maybe that's first world problems. I don't know, but I'm sure a lot of
people... Yeah, that wasn't as fun a segment as I thought it would be. Yeah.
Well, no, it was just a moment of frustration that I was curious what you made of. I think a lot of
Oh,
people
no, I agree. Yeah,
have
but
had
usually you.
these issues.
But there was no opportunity for me to mock you or to, or it was no awkwardness or embarrassing stuff. Usually, when we come out of the break, there's some kind of, it's
I
embarrassing
know.
for you in some way, and we all revel in that.
Well, maybe, I don't know. Can you revel in this kind of mis? Maybe some people do. I don't know.
You are a bit like a Steve Martin character, though. Think of any 80s movie where he's running around trying to get on a plane. I feel like most 80s movies are about people running and missing their gate or trying to get to the gate. I think that's the majority of them.
Yeah, like Home Alone or something like that. Is there,
Home
yeah.
Alone, Planes, Trains, Automobiles. What else is there? Oh, any of the National Lampoons. They're always running or traveling or trying to get somewhere.
But we got here and it's been great. Let's see. El Clasico, JJ, 3-2 Real Madrid at the Bernabeu. What a game.
Oof.
In the end, perhaps fittingly, Jude Bellingham scoring the winner for Real Madrid. It essentially seals their title hopes. If Barcelona, it was always going to be tough for Barcelona to climb back into this, but if they were going to have any chance at all, they were going to have to. I don't even think a draw would have been enough. I think they were going to have to win this game. They don't, and it's Bellingham who's kind of been the story of the season for that club, and maybe even in La Liga overall. He finds the winner, and it looks pretty much we're getting pretty close to signed, sealed, and delivered here on a league title for Real Madrid, and an exclamation mark for Bellingham in this unbelievable season that he's had.
Yeah, truly. And it just felt like it was written in the stars. It was going to be him. How many times have we seen him wheel away towards the Real Madrid supporters and just like kind of just be up on the advertising hoarding, leaning across, roaring at them? The connection he's made to the support, well, through his performances, it's been amazing. It's happened so quickly. Couple of things. 2 points of frustration for Barcelona fans. How is it possible, we all asked ourselves, not just all of us, some people who are working. Steve McManaman asked Ian Dark during the broadcast, do they not have goal line technology in La Liga?
Yeah.
So there was a corner kick taken. The ball's flicked on. I think it was Lamine Yamal flicks it on. And Lunin scoops it from either on the line, slightly behind the line, not fully over the line. We don't know. And it's very hard to get a good angle on it. So we don't know because they don't have goal line technology in one of the biggest leagues in the world. So I tried to figure this out. So ahead of the, and this is from Goal. Ahead of the 23-24 season, El Largo Herrera revealed that La Liga would remain the only top European league to not adopt goal line technology, as President Javier Tebas reportedly refused to pay, wait for it, £2.6 million sterling or $3.2 million, the sum required to implement the technology. Tebas said, after Barcelona fans criticized La Liga chief over the absence of goal line technology, Tebas took to X to respond
This is.
to his critics, where he shared a series of old incidents where goal line technology was proven wrong. He added the caption, no comment. Shut up. And he guess what he has? Of course he has Aston Villa and Sheffield United.
Of
Now,
course.
and anyone who looks into that knows that the cameras that create the goal line technology were not working. It wasn't a case that goal line technology was proven wrong. It wasn't like the ball went over the line, it didn't go over the line, or it went over the line and that it was, oh, it's not over the line, it is over the line. There was no debate that way. It was just that the camera wasn't working. It was knocked off or something. So I tried to make some funny jokes. I remember I educated you on who the Luddites were.
Sure.
They were the people during the revolution, the industrial revolution in England, who were like, we're going to lose our jobs. And they would smash the machines that they'd come into the mills. And they were called Luddites. I was going to go with La Luddites, La Liga Luddites, something like that. But,
Oh.
you know, I workshopped it and it didn't work out. But this is ridiculous from Tebas, right?
No, it's of course it's ridiculous. First of all, for one of the major sports leagues on earth, I mean, it's 2 point, what was it, 2.6 million euros?
Yeah. Pound sterling, $3.2 million. That's okay. Nothing.
I mean, right? Like, I don't know.
And I'm assuming that's implemented in every single stadium across the league. That's
right.
Nothing.
Right. That's not per club. Here's the thing that I would say to Javier Tebas. Okay, that's wonderful that you went online and found these incidents. But, like, I think the thing that I try to subscribe to, not just in sports, but in life in general, yeah. do not allow the exceptions to the rule to drive your way of thinking. If it works 98% of the time, and by the way, I think goal line technology is better than 98, but
oh, way better.
If it works 98% of the time, is it wise to allow that 2% to carry more weight? No.
So correct. I love the way you put that too. It's very, very good.
I mean, like, that's just not smart business. And sure enough, in this moment, this is a huge, it does go to show, like, it figures that Tebas made this decision thinking we can maybe I'll get burned by this in some kind of random game. No, it's Barcelona, Real Madrid with the league potentially on the line. Like, it couldn't be more high profile. And it burns him in that game of all games. It's like, it's kind of hilarious. Except if you're a Barcelona fan, because new angles, I know you said that in the moment, you know, it was frustrating going through when you're watching the game because they're going to camera angle after angle. And it doesn't seem like there's anything definitive. You think it's over, but you can't say it definitively. New angles have since emerged that I've seen still shots of that make it look like the ball is over the line. That it should have been a goal. It's still hard to say. And look, because there's the technology, it wasn't there. We'll never know for sure. But it looked, I think it did. If I had to guess one way or the other, I mean, I'll be curious to see what happens now that there's outrage over this. He's a stubborn man, Javier Tebas. We all know that about him. Will this only embolden him further to kind of say, no, F all of you. No one tells me what to do. And it's my league. And
in
I'm going to do what
actually,
I want.
In fact, actually, I want more goals and incidents like this to happen because it just drives viewers to our great league.
Right. Or will he succumb?
I just want to talk about also the other controversial moment, which was on 17 Minutes, the penalty award to Real Madrid to equalize after Christensen's opener. So Vasquez is flying down the end line, gets past Cancelo, who...
Oh.
The more I see Cancelo, the more I think Pep got it right.
He can't defend. He can't.
No.
He's good in attack. He cannot defend.
Awful stuff. Really poor. Now, so Cubarsí does the one thing. He's got his back almost to Vasquez, and he just extends his leg, just like puts it right out there. Now, I won't say playing that I haven't done it, but it's the laziest, riskiest thing you can do. It's just
so
like, I'm going to stick a foot out, see what happens. Does Vasquez kick him deliberately? Yes. But I think if you're going to make that, as we say in modern football now, if you're going to make that action in the box, you are going to leave yourself a hostage to fortune. And it's a penalty. It's does Vasquez absolutely do the old Jamie Vardy? I'm going to kick him here. And extend my leg into him, yes. But if you look what Cubarsí does, it's not wise.
It's super,
not wise at all.
Super reckless and a teachable moment for a young player with a lot of promise to him. So this week for Barcelona, it's one of the all-time bad weeks. Now, look, when you're really good, you're going to have weeks like this where you lose late in a Champions League and then have your title hopes dashed. Mm. Like it takes a certain standard, a certain level to have weeks like this. Maybe that's damning them with faint praise. I don't know, but it's an all-time bad week. And, you know, having been bounced from the Champions League the way that they were, and then this against Real Madrid, the thing that I'm trying to wonder right now with Barcelona, everything that they do is kind of, it's held up against Real Madrid. These two clubs are just permanently tied to one another. And so what I'm trying to figure out here, you know, the week that Real Madrid win in dramatic fashion against Manchester City and then beat Barcelona, in a week where Barcelona lose in dramatic fashion to PSG, like, these clubs are always going to be compared with one another. And I'm trying to project ahead. Right now, the gap feels sizable between the two. And I'm trying to project a little bit down the road as to whether or not the gap gets smaller or wider. So it's an interesting conversation because Barcelona, like we've documented, and like you can all see, some of the youth that they have on this team is just incredible. They have a phenomenal set of young players. But the problem is you can't let that obscure the fact that Real Madrid also do. Now, maybe Real Madrid's aren't 16 or 17 years old like Yamal and Cubarsí, but here's some of the guys under the age of 25 that Real Madrid have. Tchouaméni, Camavinga, Rodrigo, Brahim Diaz, Vinicius, Bellingham. On top of that, we haven't seen anything close to what Arda Güler can offer. Endrick hasn't even gotten there yet. The guy scored a match-winning goal for Brazil against England at Wembley. Hasn't even arrived yet. He'll be there soon. And I know he's 25, so it's just outside of my range here. But Kylian Mbappe is coming to Real Madrid. So, like, Barcelona's talent that they have, it's all projections. Like, we can think player X is going to be a superstar. We don't know yet what's going to happen. We don't know who their next manager is going to be that's going to continue to develop these players. Real Madrid's are not projections. These are all realized. These are all things that we can see what they've become. And, you know, the other factors to this, it seems as though, and these things can change quickly, but it seems as though Madrid can continue to spend. Barcelona are living under the constraints of severe financial limitations. It might be a one-in, one-out policy for them. Like, they might have to lose one of these young superstars to be able to do anything in the transfer window or even get back to even. So, like, I don't know. The hope that Barcelona has to lean on is that all these prominent young pieces, they're all coming up together at the same time. They've all come up through the Barcelona system. So, like, maybe there won't be a question of fit. They've all kind of been slotted into places where they belong. Whereas Real Madrid are bringing in players and asking them maybe to conform to a system. They've got a lot of players. You know, look at their front line moving forward with Vinicius, Mbappe, Rodrigo, Endrick. Like, they're going to have to keep a lot of guys happy who play similar positions. So Barcelona are going to have to rely on that. Because if it's just talent for talent and projections moving forward, I think the gap, as much as I love a lot of these young players on Barcelona, I feel like the gap is going to get wider, not smaller, between these two.
Yeah, and I feel like we are about to enter maybe a sustained period of Real Madrid dominance going forward. Now, the only thing that goes against that is, you know, how long will the coach be there?
The thought is the next one will be Xabi Alonso.
It's not like Real Madrid don't have question marks. Of course they do, but that whole league is question marks. But I think for Barcelona, this is a worrying period. And you're right. These are guaranteed things. Now, the only thing that's not guaranteed is injuries. We don't know how that will go. It's kind of grim for Barcelona. It's been a week of a week. They entered the week with a lot of possibilities still at play, and they've finished it with both of them being eradicated, and that's tough.
And look, a lot can change, and like projecting and stuff like that, like it's a dangerous game to do that. I mean, it's grim, not just for Barcelona, but for La Liga. Like, this has been a two-team league, a three-team league, if you want to include Atletico Madrid, and you should for the successes that they've had.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, are we in danger here of entering some kind of Bayern Munich-esque, Manchester City-esque, Juventus-esque? I know some of those have come to an end, Juve and Bayern. But in general, like, are we about to embark upon that, especially with Mbappe going there? I mean, I don't know. I'd be a little bit worried about the competitiveness at the top of that league over the next, you know, maybe Barcelona can hone in on Champions League and find successes in cup competitions. But I mean, if you just look at what Real Madrid are going to be rolling out there for the next 5 years or so, it's scary. It's scary how good that team is going to continue to be. Anything else on that one, JJ?
No. I enjoyed it, though. I was making lasagna as I watched it. It was Darcy's birthday, so I said I'd make lasagna, garlic bread, a little glass of wine. Big thank you also to a ex-Tottenham player. I don't want to put pressure on him now because he'll get bombarded with DMs for people wishing him happy birthday, but there was a very prominent ex-Tottenham player who wished Darcy, who was a Tottenham supporter, a happy birthday and sent a video, personalized video. So
that is amazing. You won't say who it was?
Because it was done through one through a contact.
Okay.
I don't feel comfortable.
Okay. I'll honor that. It's a shame, though, because it was a really nice thing this guy did.
Yeah, it was very nice, and it was great. Yeah, but I don't want to, because I don't want him getting bombarded by asking for messages. It was a favor for her. It was her birthday present gift, whatever. So there you go.
Let's see, JJ, you have anything on MLS? I just have two U.S. men things to close out with. If you've got anything before that,
Let me just do a quick MLS thing, and then we'll get to some rather grim business, I would say, from you. Grim business. That's unfair, but not happy news. So I just want to say, Saturday night, two teams I've kind of been looking at and focusing at, locked horns, from the west and from the east. LAFC played out a 2-2 draw with New York Red Bulls. Denny Buanga with a late equalizer. It looked as if Emil Forsberg's 81st minute strike was going to be enough. Buanga equalizes, and that finishes 2-2. And the Red Bulls are better, Andrew, this season. They are a lot better. The Athletic did like this graph, which is very good. It's how MLS teams' performance has changed since last season, based on the sample size of we're a quarter way through this season now, so we have enough stats to kind of make some comments. So, for example, which really tallies considering the scoreline at the weekend for the LA Galaxy against San Jose, the 4-3 game. Good attack, bad defense. Occupying that zone very strongly is the Los Angeles Galaxy and Philadelphia Union as well. And then the Red Bulls are kind of in the bad attack, good defense zone. Which is true. They only had two shots on target against LAFC. But the vibe I'm getting here is, though, that this is a more resolute outfit that the Red Bulls have. They probably need to up production, but they have a player like Forsberg that can do that. And Denny Buanga scored both goals for LAFC. We went into the season, is this guy going to down tools? Is he going to force his way out? He seemed desperate to get back to the league on. 9 appearances so far, Andrew, 5 goals, 2 assists in the starting 11 all the time, plays 100% of the minutes. So I guess he's changed his mind, or things have been stabilized. But yeah, Buanga just been very, very good for LAFC. That was my just quick MLS note there.
There you go. Let's see, closing out with a couple of U.S. men things. And it's not great news for one in particular. No. It's terrible news. PSV Eindhoven announced that Sergiño Dest suffered a knee injury in training. He is done for the season. And I would say there are serious doubts now over his participation in Copa America. I would be surprised if he's there. It's a brutal blow. It's not necessarily a position where the U.S. are overflowing with a surplus of talent. He's proven himself. He's a lock first team player for Berhalter. What he's done down the right side, you can, first of all, in defense, like he has speed where he can, he can put the afterburners on, kind of like a Kyle Walker almost, and make up for any mistakes that he makes when he's pushing forward too much. But in attack,
he's
him
a
and
huge part.
Him and Tim Weah, what they've been able to kind of combine to do on that side is, you've always just kind of felt good about what's there, and it shifts now. It's going to be up to Joe Scally. I would assume if Dest can't go, Scally will be the one who fills in, takes that spot. The hype around him has been there for a while. There will be people out there who tell you he can do this. He's up for this. We'll see. We've seen what Dest offers, and he's very important, extremely important to this U.S. team. And if he's not a Copa America, that's really unfortunate. He's one of the most important players on the team. And it's going to be a lot on Joe Scally to be able to fill those shoes. Or if he doesn't have to fill those shoes entirely, other guys will have to step up in ways, and maybe they can do it. Maybe they'll be fine. But yeah, I felt bad for Dest, because this is going to be a big summer for the team and for him. Yeah, it's a tough way for his club season to end. And then
for like Greg Berhalter, the wide fullbacks are very important to what he tries to do, and that's just not good news at all. And I hate the vagueness of PSV as well. Serious knee injury. Sorry, that won't cut it for us fans. We need details. Is
I'm
meniscus?
Sure those will come. I'm sure
ACL. Is it what? Oh,
yeah. I'm sure we'll find out whatever that means. But yeah, in the immediacy, serious knee injury, that is not a sentence you want to read. And then last one here, I'm reading this from Fansided. They say the journalist Mirko Di Natale reported on X that McKinney, Weston McKinney, rejected the first renewal proposal on a contract offer for Juve, the same current salary of 2.5 million euros, 1 year plus an option for the second. The negotiation will continue. If the parties do not reach an agreement, the midfielder will be on the market. That's from Mirko Di Natale. They go on to say in this article here, McKinney deserves to be paid his worth and feel valued at Juventus. It would be a shame to see the USMNT player join a club in MLS or the Saudi Pro League just for money. He's got 10 assists this season for Juve. It's been one of his, maybe his best season since he's been a professional soccer player. He's been huge for them. He probably does deserve to get some sort of a raise, some sort of financial acknowledgement of what he's been able to do there.
This could be part of the game. This could be all part of negotiations, just something that's leaked out. He may have every intent to stay and he just wants to figure it out. I don't know. But yeah, he's had a great season and Juve seem anxious to lock him down.
Yeah, and I hope he stays there because it's, his progress at that club has been noticeable. And I think the fans have really taken to him. It just feels like this is not the moment for him to make some move. And look, the article there, they throw out their MLS or the Saudi Pro League. I mean, I hope
I can't see it.
I don't think that would happen at this point. He's still a young player, relatively young player, and he's thriving in a major European league. I don't know. The Saudi money is an X factor that you can never totally discount that, but boy, that would really surprise me. And it would be really disappointing as well. I'd like to see him stay at Juve or certainly at the bare minimum, one of the top leagues in Europe. So we'll see, we'll monitor those things, but yeah, bummer for Serginho Dest and some intrigue right now around Weston McKinney. JJ, you have anything else?
I do not, Andrew. I don't.
All right. I think my family, it's a little overcast today. I'm not sure this is a beach and pool day. My boy, I think there's mini golf on the horizon here. They just want to rent a golf cart. They want, because I'll let them sit on my lap and I let them drive it. I'll go to an empty parking lot and they can drive a golf cart. Don't tell on me.
No, I won't. But I can imagine just the fun of a golf cart. Yeah, I get that. Is go karting an option?
Go kart? No, not here. I haven't seen that.
No, okay.
Golf cart. Yeah,
I like mini golf. Mini golf's great game.
Yeah, I agree. It's good fun. We might go fishing. So there's even if we can't get to the beach, that's all right. There's still a lot to do here in the critter capital of the world. JJ, I enjoyed this immensely. I'm going to go be with my family now. I hope the same for you. Enjoy your week. We'll be back with another one of these later on. Manchester City, important game on Thursday afternoon, so we might get the pod to you a little bit later than normal because we want to make sure we know what happens with them with regards to any Premier League title race, because that's obviously going to be a huge fixture in the battle for first in the Premier League. Hey, JJ, to you I say...
Check you later, phone boy.
I'll see you.
Take care.
You've been listening to the Caught Offside Soccer Podcast.